Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is the CEO of Tate Towers, Winky Fairworth. Winky, good to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, now this is behind the scenes stuff. And most people, so we got to start at ground zero. What exactly is Tate Towers?
Well, if you really want to start at ground zero, it actually goes before Tate Towers. It would go to Michael Tate. And so Michael Tate, who's Australian and probably 73 years old-ish by now, and he'd be pissed at me to tell the world that. But
he, is he involved in the business at all anymore?
No, sir.
Okay.
But he loves going there, and he loves building shit for his bathroom or something like that. And his name's still on the sign, and you know, it was part of my doing was to create this legacy for this man who he goes back. So he started in Australia. He immigrated to England in the 60s, and he was working at the speakeasies in London and fell upon Yes and became, you know, he answered the magical question in the industry of can you drive the van, which was a resounding yes, and he became the fifth member of the band.
Whoa. Let's just be clear. What do you mean drive the van?
The van, right? Like,
oh,
who
can
the
you drive
fuck's
going
to take us to the next gig,
right? Exactly.
Michael raised his hand and said, I'll do it. So he was interested in lighting at the time. He was, you know, rummaging the streets of London with Richard Hartman, stealing park cans off the street and building them in their apartment together. And his passion was lighting. And so when he joined with Yes, he did all their lights. And it was his idea to put the group in the round in 1978, which changed the game. It totally changed the game.
In what way did it change the game?
Several ways. So number one, you're now selling every ticket in the arena. And when you think about what the arenas were like then, it ain't what they're like now, right? You weren't hanging £1 million from the ceiling. You were ground stacking. You could barely get a lighting rig. And you know, those buildings weren't built for sports back then. Who knows what the hell they were built for. So in addition to selling the tickets, he had to solve the production requirements. So what is different in playing in the round? The sound's quite different. Well, he just happened to have a best friend named Roy Clare, who was doing sound for Yes, who happened to be the biggest sound company in the world at the time. And they figured it out, right? How do you light a show in the round? It's completely different. You don't have a backdrop to light. You're now kind of the rig becomes an iconic kind of structure that's almost like a sculpture. And if you go back and look at Yes in the Round, it was a big star that was beautiful to look at. And then you got to teach your band to play in the round because they don't know how to do that. And so Michael overcame all those obstacles and with great success. And because of his relationship with Clare Brothers at the time, he was getting ready to be booted out of England, and he came to Lititz, Pennsylvania, which is where Clare Brothers started. They were both, Roy and Gene, were born in Lititz, Pennsylvania. And we were in a building.
For my listeners who may be geographically challenged, where exactly is Lititz?
That is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 5 miles north of the city in Lancaster, 60 miles outside of Philadelphia.
Pennsylvania Dutch country.
Total. Like, we'll have Amish buggies strapped to our building at any given moment on any given day, which is a great contrast of rock and roll, right? Like, it's a great, you know, you could be building Ozzy Osbourne at the time and you'll have an Amish buggy at your front door. It's pretty wild. And so he started a shop there. And as soon as he came to America, Barry Manilow wanted to play in the round. Diana Ross wanted to play in the round. Kenny Rogers played in the round.
So he was that he specialized in the round.
Only because that's what he succeeded in and people wanted to follow suit. He was a lighting guy, right? And so if you go back, I started in 1984. And today may be the day that is the 35th anniversary. I'm not sure what the day was, but it was the first 2 weeks of April. So I have no idea, but it's 35 years to the day that I walked in that door. And at the time, we were a lighting company. But we were a lighting company and no fucking idea what we were doing. Like,
well,
I was,
let's slow down a little bit. So when he got into lighting, was there – like, Clare was the big sound company and there was Shoco.
There was Shoco, which I was just getting to. They were – just starting, right? Like the very lights that went out with Genesis at the time were just happening, right? And the way I tell the story is Shoco was probably spending more on research and development at that time than we were grossing, right? We knew there was going to be a problem. And it was the staging that was consistently bailing us out because to be a lighting company at that time, you would go to the bank, you'd borrow a bunch of money, you'd build your system, you'd hire the guys who were freelance guys, and you would hope to God that the band would pay for the equipment before it became obsolete. But it never did, right?
That would mean that you're running it in the red.
It was happening, but the technology was innovating so fast and being driven mostly by Very Light. But we had some great clients at the time. We had U2.
Okay.
We had Kenny Rogers. So we had something there.
Okay, just because not everybody's sophisticated.
Go on.
Tell them what a Very Light is.
That was the first moving light with a dichroic filter that could change color at any moment. And I think it was Genesis. I don't remember the exact tour.
I think Seconds Out?
Yeah, they had 400 of them. It was the most mind-blowing thing you've ever seen. And from that moment on, it was a game changer.
Okay, to the degree you know what was going on before this era, before Yes in the Round.
Well, there was a ton of companies doing this. You know, there was TTF, there was Bob C, there was a bunch of companies that were doing it, but nobody was doing it on the level that Genesis and Shoko were doing it. Nobody was doing it on the level that Clare Brothers were doing it. And so we had something to aspire to, right? We had something, we fell into a niche that we could specialize in, and that was building stages. Nobody, you know, stages weren't stages then. They were drum risers. They were risers and carpet.
Okay, when you say stage, you mean the stage, the lights, and everything, right?
No, I mean the set, right? Okay. I mean the set. It's the performance environment for the artists. It's their living room. Lights are a commodity. They're rented. Video is now a commodity. It's rented. Sound is now a commodity. It's rented. But when you get to staging, that's very custom to the artist, and it has to go in and out just as fast as everything else does. So you have to kind of commoditize it in a very custom way so that it works for everybody. And we consistently spent time reinvesting in our company. Like, so when a show arrives in the morning, which most people have no idea, right? So let's just take any show these days that's 20 trucks of equipment. It gets to the gig. It's 7 o'clock in the morning, right? On the day of the show, you've got until sound check to put it together. And ideally, for what we do, we put it together with no fasteners and no tools. Because guess what you lose at the gig, right? Fasteners and tools. Where's my...
So what holds it together if there's
intuitive
no fasteners?
Intuitive connections, which are very proprietary and very innovative and something that we have collected in our arsenal for 30, 40 years.
What would that be?
It would be a conical connector of some type that is very intuitive and very safe and might be spring-loaded, might have a clip on it. You know, there's all kinds of ways that you can make clever connections these days with innovation and technology and machining.
Okay, let's go back to the narrative, though. Okay.
So, yeah.
You're doing everybody in the round. And then what's the next step?
Next step is selling the lighting company in 1987 to Nocturne, Herbie and Journey, for argument's sake. Because they were also very forward-thinking in the fact that, hey, we're a huge band. We're going to do this a lot. Why don't we own our own production company? And they did it, right? And we were pretty attractive to them at the time. We had a bunch of clients. Bruce Springsteen was just going out what the hell was the name of the tour?
Tunnel of Love?
No, it was Born in the USA. I believe that was like his big commercial break at
that
the time.
That was a stadium tour.
Giant stadium tour. We had some crazy
lighting
stuff.
Okay, but just so I know. Okay, you're talking about U2. You talk about the Very Lights that are basically 1980. In that break from 1980 to you sell to Herbie, what services is Tate providing?
Lighting and staging.
Okay.
And we're losing money on the lighting. And we're breaking even on the staging to pay for the lighting. So we're thinking we're doing well, but we're not.
Okay, just to be clear, since you start within the round, how does it evolve to staging in general?
I don't understand that question. Be more specific.
Okay, it sounds, you know, Michael Tate, that's his first name, Michael,
yes.
Right? He started off doing Yes in the Round. He did Kenny Rogers in the Round, et cetera. So he's the in the round guy.
But in the round was just another form of staging, let's say. I mean, there were plenty of other shows we were doing at the time.
Right.
But the boutique, you know, the expertise came with playing in the round because we had solved the problems, right?
It's like
doing a boxing match in an arena. Michael aspired to getting a seating chart from a Frank Sinatra show when he first did Yes. Like, I'll just use a boxing seating chart because that must work, right?
But the main motivation was to sell the back of the house, which you couldn't do.
Absolutely. The promoters and the managers just loved them to death.
Okay. So now you sell the lighting to Nocturne, Journey, and Herbie Herbert.
Yes.
And what does that leave you with, the staging?
That leaves you with enough money to go decide that you want to build a real company. And so that was about 1989. We broke ground on the first facility, I believe, in the world that was custom built to build staging and scenery for the touring entertainment business. And we designed the building so that we had enough space to set something up. And we designed the building to be a real factory. So like the last place that all the gear ended up was in the paint booth. The paint booth was by the loading dock and off it went in the truck. And it was the beginning of kind of professionalizing and maturing a carnival industry, right?
Okay. And when that happened, when you sold to Nocturne and you built your building, how many employees were there then?
Oh, my. Probably 20.
Okay. And right now there are?
600.
Okay. So
And that building, I might add, was a postage stamp compared to the 500,000 square feet of production facilities that we now currently operate with.
Just to jump ahead, you built a rehearsal hall like 6-8 years ago.
Oh, no, 2 years ago.
Was it that recently?
Yeah.
Okay, how that—
Took 10 years to get it together.
Right. So—
Another game changer.
Okay, tell my audience.
It's a game changer because prior to having a facility like that, these shows have been getting complicated since the 90s. And when you take a show to go rehearse it, and rehearsing sometimes means we don't really need the artist. We need to rehearse this technically. There's no place to do it, right? Where do you do it? The A-Market arenas are booked solid with basketball, hockey, concerts. So you'd go to like Sheboygan Nowhere or Baton Rouge Nowhere or somewhere that's a C-Market building. And now all of a sudden you have to compromise the show that you're trying to flush out because the building's not big enough, tall enough to support it. Something that drove us crazy for a long time. To be able to have the luxury of having, basically we have a Staples Center in Lititz, Pennsylvania that has no seats. We can hang 1 million pounds from the ceiling.
Wait, it's just the staging area. It's not something like as big as an arena.
It is as big as an arena with no seats. You take that hockey dasher and get rid of the seats. It's 100 feet tall. You can hang. We've rehearsed stadium shows inside our rehearsal facility. It's that big, right?
Okay. So in a year, approximately how many shows do you do?
Wow. No freaking clue. I mean, we probably have 25 shows on the road right now of just touring shows.
Okay, so those 25 touring shows, if you have one rehearsal hall— Sounds like you needed an additional rehearsing hall.
Yeah, but it took 10 years to get this one, and it's in Lititz, Pennsylvania. Like, the thought of doing something like that out here in California is crazy. It's unaffordable. You know, it's almost unaffordable where we live, but it's a luxury to us, and it supports an industry that we feel very strongly about. So if the thing can pay for itself, we're quite ecstatic about it, because to be able to take the show that you're building next door— It's helping everybody.
Okay. And how many acts after you build it literally come rehearse?
It's booked. It's booked all the time. Ariana Grande just left last week. There's something incredibly top secret in there right now. And it's going.
So let's just assume I'm going to rehearse in your room. How much time do I need?
Depends on how big your show is. And it depends on your artist, right? Some artists rehearse for a month. They want to get the choreography. They want to get the programming. Some artists rehearse for 3 days. Some artists don't rehearse at all. You know, Elton John, his show was in our rehearsal facility, but that man can go sit at a piano and bang it out for a show with no problem, right? The guy does not need to rehearse. His environment doesn't matter, right? His environment is his seat at his piano with the relationship to his musicians. He doesn't even know where he is.
Okay,
right?
Let's go back. I've seen the show. The show is great. But at the end, he goes on like a little, you know, elevator ride.
Yes.
Okay, but there's a chain that he locks, okay?
Well, of course there is, because he's got an insurance agent who's probably stressed out of his brain, like, oh, my God, what are we going to do if he falls?
Okay, so that was driven by insurance.
Usually those things. I mean, hey, if it would make you feel comfortable, we'd strap you in. Like, ideally, you want to keep everybody safe. We have other redundancies of safety, but who knows what could happen to somebody, you know?
Okay, but that was driven not by the act, by insurance.
Can't speak to that directly.
Okay. Let me ask you quite a question. Do you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't, you know.
Okay. I don't need to push that because, you know, Elton's hips, he's not moving too fast
right,
himself.
You know?
Right. Okay, but let's go back. So you sell to Nocturne, you're in the staging business, and you professionalize it.
By our facilities, yeah. And then the next thing that happens in this world is our friends at Q Prime and Metallica decide to fight with Napster, which for us was the best thing that ever happened in the world.
Okay, right? You got to explain it.
Well, there we are. You know, you could say, oh, God, you guys were genius. What a great strategy. We had nothing to do with it. Didn't even know it was happening. At that point in time, the paradigm has shifted. As you write about, as you talk about, artists don't make money selling records. They don't make money on their recordings. They make money in the arenas. And now all of a sudden, touring becomes a brand. Touring becomes your revenue stream. And touring becomes the way you make your money. And so the show, I think, has changed dynamically immensely, right? Like, it's not even the same as it used to be. It's now a spectacle, right? There's a few artists who still have the musicality to go into an arena and use an Oriental rug and a microphone stand. Very rare, right? Very rare. Even some of the legends who have gone through their careers without having big productions all of a sudden have a nicer living room.
Okay. In terms of ticket sales, I know this is not literally your area of expertise. Do you think the production makes it so people come? Or these, if you're assuming you can play, you could sell the tickets without production?
It's a tough question to answer based on the fact that I don't have the facts, but
right.
I can tell you what I feel like. I mean, there's so much competition out there, and I think that the buyers are incredibly educated, and they know who's putting on a spectacle and who's not. And so it's a choice, right? It's how much of a groupie or a music fan are you, where you don't care about the production, but if you look at what social media has done to being at the event and having a big splash at the event, it's a game changer. It's a total game changer. And every artist that we deal with knows what every other artist is doing out there.
Okay. Just to be clear, you seem to say that a lot of musicians couldn't play without the staging anyway.
No. I didn't say that.
Okay.
I said I don't think that they could sell as many tickets.
Ah.
They certainly can play musically. Come on. They could go play in a club.
Well, some can and some can't. Okay. But, okay, so now you professionalize it. When you say Cliff Bernstein, Q Prime, and Napster, you're just talking about the change in the scene or something specific that they did?
Well, they took Napster down, right? They single-handedly changed the landscape of the industry, I believe. It wouldn't have gone the way it is had that not happened, I don't believe. If the artists are still making money like they used to make on those records, maybe touring's not as important as it is now. But it became the source of revenue, right? So it's your brand. What do you want your brand to look like? It didn't used to be, right? What did it used to be look like? You'd go on tour, you'd lose money
right.
to promote a record. Now, I don't know why they were losing money.
Well, they didn't realize how much money was out there, and a lot of times they didn't want to charge worrying about fan alienation. But, okay, I know from talking to the Metallica guys, whatever, that generally speaking, let me put it this way, does the act own the stage?
No, sir.
You own it all?
Well, we used to sell it in the 80s and the 90s, and I traveled around the world to several depots. There was one at Upstaging in Chicago. There was one in...
Explain what Upstaging is.
It's a lighting and trucking company that has a depot in Chicago. There was Mojo Barricades in Holland, which had a great storage facility. We had a storage facility. And it wasn't good for the earth. It just wasn't. Like this. So the scenario that existed back then is somebody would spend a lot of money for a stage set. They would own it. The lawyers and the accountants and the manager of the artist could never agree what to do with it when they were finished with it because they thought it was this giant asset that was completely reusable. But the fact of the matter is it was completely depreciated. Nobody was going to bring that thing out. And it was stored in such a way where very few humans could go find it and know what the hell to do with it to begin with. So it was hundreds of trucks. You think about some of these shows, the U2s, the Rolling Stones, the Tina, their shows were big and they toured often. So hundreds and hundreds of trucks throughout the world just sitting there. Now, there were people like us who were collecting rent on storage. But aside from that, it was a terrible thing for the environment.
Okay, just to be clear, I come off the road 50-city tour. It literally sits in the truck?
For years. No. Well, it could sit in the truck in some places. They would literally, because trailers are cheap, they'd go store it somewhere in California or Arizona. But we had, you know, climate-controlled environments where we would put things. We would never see the light of day, ever. And so now it bothered me to the point where I tried to change the business model. And I thought to myself, it's like renting a car, right? There is a very specific armature of every stage set that's like an Erector set. The decking, the stairs, the elevators, a lot of the mechanics. There's a guts to that show that you see every time you walk into arena that nobody's actually seeing. Right? It could be 50% of the guts, 75%, but you dress that guts up with all the stylistic versions of how we portray these shows. And now all of a sudden you've got something that's actually sustainable and we're able to give more of a show to an artist than we could before because we're getting some of it back and we're getting the useful bits back. We're getting all the automation, all the computers. We're getting all the power transmissions, and they're quite easily recyclable.
And what is not recyclable at this time?
Scenery, right? Scenery or something that's so stylistic for that artist or that show that it would easily be identified, oh, that was for so-and-so or this was for so-and-so.
And what do you do with that stuff?
Chuck it.
Okay. So there's this big switch in the internet Napster era where, you know, the tour – as opposed to being advertisement for the record, it flips, and the record is the advertisement for the tour. In the 20 years that have gone by since the advent of Napster, what other changes have taken place?
So I would attribute the next biggest change in our business and in our industry to the Rolling Stones Steel Wheels Tour. I think it was 1990.
Yeah, 89.
And Mark Fisher was the set designer for that show, who's since passed away, but he was one of the preeminent stage designers in the world.
Just to stop you for a second, I know from reading your materials, you have a scholarship or a foundation.
I do.
Why don't you explain that?
Well, Mark was a dear friend of mine. He passed away from a cancer that he should have never passed away from. He was English, didn't go to the doctor as much as he should have. Mark was the first guy in this world who could take the discipline of architecture and move it over into set design. And Mark's history goes back with Roger Waters, the inflatables from the wall. Mark built the very first wall by himself and operated with his partner, Jonathan, at the time. And our scholarship is to try to show architectural students in England that this opportunity exists because our industry is a secret. And it's very hard for young talent, whether they're engineers, designers, architects, it's very hard to bust into this industry. I've made it a challenge to myself to go around and speak at schools, through the scholarship, whatever it is, to explain those opportunities that exist. But it's hard convincing people that this is a real job, right? It's a real job, not like going to an engineering firm.
Right. No. Well, the insiders know, but I don't want to lose the thread. So what happens with Mark Fisher and the Steel Wheels Tour?
So it's the first time that an outdoor stadium show was stylistically, architecturally done. Prior to that, every show you would have seen outdoors had looked like two cereal boxes with a shoebox in the middle, like a diorama. And the two towers on each side held the PA, and the tower in the middle was a roof, which we thought would keep an artist dry in the rain, which it never did because the roof was so high and it always rained sideways. And Mark was the first guy to talk Mick Jagger into the fact that, hey, you're going to do an outdoor show and you're going to get wet. And if you get wet, I can make you something that looks like something. And it happened. And on Steel Wheels, it was a big deal, right? That was a big deal. That thing was like 300 feet wide in a stadium, which you'd never be able to do if you tried to keep the artist dry, right? And so I think that changed the game. It also led to these massive globally produced tours, which became much more logistically challenging. So the Steel Wheels Tour was the last tour that Michael Ahearn did with the Rolling Stones. And the next tour, Jake Berry came into play. And Jake really...
Why don't you explain what the role of those people is?
So Jake would be the production manager, the tour manager, you know, the organizer of moving this army of people and equipment around. And Jake, funny enough, right, as there's always 6 degrees of separation, Jake was Rick Wakeman's keyboard roadie with Yes. And so he had known Michael Tate for quite some time. And he was out with, you know, Motley Crue and Metallica. He had a huge career leading up to this. So he had enough information, but it had never been executed the way that he executed on the next Rolling Stones tour, which was the Voodoo Lounge. And so on that particular tour, we changed the way the show moved. What was called Universal Production became a much bigger system. So when you do a stadium show, when you do a stadium show, you will have two or three sets of steel, which is your infrastructure to hang everything. That kind of moves in and out and leapfrogs, as we call it. So if one's being built in one city, one's being performed on in another city, and the other one's being torn down and you're playing a shell game of city to city. But Jake kind of took the bull by the horns to make Universal Production a much bigger scope. So the things that we can take in and out the day before a stadium show and the night after the show has grown exponentially to the point where it's probably bigger than what you're taking on any arena show, right? Taylor Swift, the last Taylor Swift tour, we had 52 trucks just of our equipment universally going in and out of a stadium. It's unheard of. And Jake pioneered that to change the game, to make it more efficient to have these giant shows touring in a stadium, right? Because it's all to the bottom line now.
Okay, so that's changed. What else is happening in the modern era?
Now, if you go past that, it's automation. So flying artists, flying cameras, what we refer to it as axes of motion. So if you go to a Cirque du Soleil show in Las Vegas Strip, we're automating all of those shows. That's now spilled into rock and roll. Rock and roll has always had automation in a show, but maybe like three axes of motion. Now the Red Hot Chili Peppers have 1,000 axes of motion on a show. How do you control that? That's all done with automation. And so we used to have little gray boxes with switches on them, and you'd pray to God the light was green, and you'd press the button, and something would happen. That's not safe anymore, and that's not the way you can control a huge show in an arena. So the software now has a ton of flexibility to control the movements. It's all time-coded usually to the music with the lights and the video, and it provides several safety layers of redundancy. So like if I tell the computer to do something and it knows that something's happening over here that's not where it should be, it won't let you do it. That ain't how it used to work. You'd press the button, and if somebody's foot was in the way, you'd hear them scream, right? That's not what we want to be doing anymore. So automation now, it's another company almost within our company, right? We have a software platform. It's called Navigator, and it runs probably 100 shows every night in the world.
Okay. So if you use this stuff, how do you sync it with a performance?
You program it. You program it just like automated lights are being programmed. And in fact, we could control the lights. We could control the video. We go in. We're usually underused in that environment. But we have to be robust enough to anticipate anything. And if you look at it in a Cirque show or in a theater show, it's very robust. So these types of software are now controlling the Metropolitan Opera House, right? Any old opera house that had line sets in their stage, old-fashioned counter, they're all being replaced with automation now.
Okay, I mean with the sandbags and you pull it up and
yeah,
down.
Yeah, that's no –
okay. But let's assume you're a rock band.
Yes.
And you have all these things. So how do you keep everything in sync? The band has a click track or what?
Depends on the band, but usually there is a time code that things are being clicked to. I mean, let's face it. Bands always want to jam. Bands, right? But not everybody's a band. And if somebody like the Red Hot Chili Peppers want to jam, you can make it happen. You can put spots in the set where you can do it. Some spots might be highly programmed. Some spots might not be. But then there's other artists where every breath and every step is highly choreographed and everything has to be in sync. So there's click tracks happening all the time.
Okay, let's go back to you personally. You're from where?
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia. And you grow up, what does your father do for a living?
Oh, he was a professional alcoholic.
Professional alcoholic. That's
sure.
That's kind of rare for a Jew. I mean, I'm a Jew. I can say that.
Yeah. No, none of this had anything to do with family upbringing. I lived in Philadelphia. I went to college in Millersville University, which just happened to be 4 miles away from Lidditz. My best friend in college was a man by the name of Barry Clare, who I met day one. And it was Roy Clare's son. And we became best friends. And at some point in college, I needed a job. And I met Michael Tate, who was like the Willy Wonka of entertainment, who my interview was basically, what can you do? I was like, I don't know. I was 19 years old. Can you operate a router? I'm like, no, I'm Jewish. We don't use power tools. What are you talking about? He said, what's the square root of 49? I said, 7. He said, can you start today? And it went pretty well.
And at the time, you were employee number, I mean, how many people were working?
12.
Okay.
11, something insane.
I mean, obviously, talking to you, you have the gift of gab. You're a very smart guy, whatever. But if someone sees you, you're a guy in a T-shirt. How did you end up as CEO?
Because we were – I saw the vision. I saw this man and I had the vision of what could happen with this. I mean, I was – growing up as a kid, I was a drummer. I used to go to shows at the Spectrum in Philadelphia and sneak a camera in to shoot. You know, I would take my zoom lens and I would hollow out an Italian roll and wrap it up in saran wrap, put lettuce and tomato on the top. I'd go shoot David Bowie. I'd go shoot I just love music. And to see that opportunity, like me, like everybody else, would go to all those shows and have no idea what it took to make those shows.
Right.
None. You'd say, oh, the Spectrum did a great job tonight, right?
Right.
It had nothing to do with the Spectrum. So he was a very inspiring man with a great sense of humor. He's Australian. He had a great sense of humor. And we were living the dream. It was a hobby, right? But it was a business. But I had to professionalize that. In 1989, I was going to split. I was going to go to Universal Studios. I had some friends that were going to build the theme park in Orlando. Michael had some weird business partner, and I was done. And I said, I'm out of here. And he said, no, you're not. I'm firing that guy. You're sticking around. And we took off, right? That was part of building the building. I said, if you want me around, you have to be invested in this, just like I'm invested in this. I had no idea I was going to be invested in something for 35 years, but fuck, it's been a good ride, right?
Okay. So ultimately, even though Tate's name was on the building, so to speak, you were the man with the vision.
Yeah. I mean, Michael, obviously he had a vision before I showed up, but I don't think he had a vision this far into the future. I don't think that's how his brain worked.
And did you have to put any money in it personally?
Sweat. I didn't have any money.
Okay.
No money. I mean, back then, we would be working 80, 90 hours a week. Nobody ever told us that, you know, you had to come to work and nobody left at 5 o'clock, right? You left when you knew that was all you could do for the day, but you knew when the show had to leave and that's all you cared about. And it ain't like that anymore.
Well, tell us how it's like today.
It's millennials.
And you have personal experience. What does that look like?
No, in all fairness, right, we have a great organization of people. Like, the thing that's very difficult that I experienced younger in my career is every show is a fire drill. And after 10 fire drills, you don't fucking want to go outside anymore. You're like, I don't care if the building's burning, right? Like, it's not right for a human to just get up every day for a new emergency. And we had to learn that in our business, which is why our business is so robust right now, right? There was a moment in time where I turned around and the business was so robust because the industry was so dysfunctional. Everything was an emergency. Nothing was planned. Most of the time, we're building a show after tickets go on sale, right? It's a crazy phenomenon. And it's not for no reason other than we can't make up our mind. So I looked at that and said to ourselves, shit, all of a sudden, our business is actually more robust than the industry. It can't support us. So we had to go find other avenues of work, which we've done very successfully now, but it's taken a long time. But it was driven by the dysfunction of rock and roll.
And then tell us what the other avenues are.
So we have the automation company is a very big avenue. We can be doing shows that we're controlling, that we've built nothing. We have a theme park business that's off the hook. We have proprietary software that's in all the theme parks with whose ever name is on the title that doesn't involve driving a roller coaster, but it involves driving everything else that's in a theme park that's not a ride. And there's a lot of that, right? How do you keep people amused while they're waiting in line? There's a lot of stuff happening. Kinetic architecture has become a huge thing.
What is that?
So if you stand at Times Square these days and you look up at the billboards, you say to yourself, why aren't these billboards moving? Wouldn't it be so much cooler? And next thing you know, there's a Coke thing that's moving in and out. So we're building scoreboards in Arena that have kinetic architecture because all these people get a buzz from rock and roll, right? Like if you go do a corporate event, they want to have a rock star there. All of a sudden, a corporate event is now a rock show. But there's speakers and there's salespeople. But at the end of the day, it's a rock show. And so we've always been the redheaded stepchildren of theater. But theater has always stole our shit and put it on Broadway and put it in the West End. The same thing has happened in architecture now. It's not really good enough to go build a billion-dollar building. You got to build a billion-dollar building that has a gag in the lobby or has something on the side of it to attract people, to get the social media, to have people gathering. And it's happening every day now.
Okay. You got into it for the music. Are you still as excited about the music?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's challenging, right? Like it's a different type of music these days. But, you know, let's just talk about the show we went to the other night, right?
Right.
The Michael Bublé show. It's all about the music, right? But there's an awful lot of work there to get that performance environment to be about the music, right? You still have to have an elegant delivery of that show. And, you know, Bruce Allen and Randy Burswick, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
That's the management company.
They see the value in it. Randy, it's funny that you know both of my friends, Tony DiCiaccio and Randy Burswick, because
right.
I've always assimilated those two organizations, which are on either side of the country, as very similar. The way that they worked with their musicians and the way that they worked with production. And
that's Q Prime and Bruce Allen.
And Randy has been doing this. I did my first show with Randy, Bryan Adams, Waking Up the Neighborhood in 1990 or something. And we've had a great relationship since. And he gets it, right? Like every element that you saw in that show, we have toiled over it with designers, with cost. Because at the end of the day, a guy like Randy and myself have to make the decision between art and commerce, right? What costs what? What kind of bang do you get for your buck? And what are we doing here? And that's a pretty product that we have out there.
Okay, let's talk about U2 for a second, just to separate things out.
Yep.
U2 did their arena tour with the screen in the middle they walked through, okay?
The one that we're talking about, Innocence and Experience.
Right.
Yeah.
How much of that is you? Is the screen?
The whole screen is ours. But, I mean, the video product
right.
is a commodity. It's rented.
Right.
It comes from somebody else. But everything that's mounted to, the way it's deployed, the structure that holds it, and the winches that raise and lower it are all ours.
Okay. Since you're talking about winches, let's talk about safety. You go to the gig, and you see all this stuff hanging. You know, are these buildings strong enough to hold all that stuff?
Sure. There's a ton of advance work that goes into these shows. You know, from the production manager to the house rigger to the engineers of the building to the third-party engineers that we all hire, it is advanced months before you get there. And buildings, you know, these production teams will travel. If there's a building that they're not sure of, they'll go there. They'll go to the building and do a site survey, and it's very well thought out.
And you've been doing this for 35 years. Have there ever been any accidents?
Accidents happen. Yeah, there have been accidents. There was an accident that happened last week in Coachella on Saturday.
Right.
But they're rare.
But that guy wasn't wearing a safety harness, right?
True, but
most people don't.
I don't know. I can't speak to that. I mean, it's, you know, 25 years ago, safety harnesses didn't exist.
Right.
Right? People were walking the beams of a rafter. It's called an accident. Yeah. But if you look at the amount of shows that happen, I would assimilate it to the airline industry, right? If you look at the amount of shows that happen versus the amount of planes that take off every single day and the times you hear about an accident, it's an accident.
Just to be clear, that we could – I don't know the details, but we could attribute that accident in Coachella to human error. Does the equipment ever fail?
Sure. Yeah, it's like a car, right? Does your car ever run out of gas? Does your car run out of oil? Does a bearing pop? Absolutely. But we spend a lot of time trying to mitigate anything that we can expect. We've probably had every single thing go wrong that you could imagine in testing or in our life. So when we go to build something, we kind of know what could fail.
Okay, so you talk about all these new businesses. They come to you or you pitch them?
They come to us, but there's a few pitches. I mean, our shows are our best form of advertising, right? When you go into a building, you'll see our set carts. You'll see our product. We are very well branded. People know our equipment. And the stagehands throughout the country welcome our equipment, right? We spent a lot of time trying to empower local stagehands who put our shows together to make them feel part of the show. That was never done before, right? So what I mean by that is if you pull a cart off of a truck in a building, that cart's going to tell you everything there is to know about what's in that cart, where it goes on the show, what it's called. So instead of saying, hey, where do you want me to put this, they now have the vernacular to speak that the entire show speaks. They know where everything is. They feel empowered, and they feel part of the show. And that's made a huge difference, and it's great for our brand.
So let's say you have an arena show. How many stagehands are with the tour, and how many are picked up at the gig?
You know, that depends on how big the show is. That's not an easy question to answer. But I would say there's usually somewhere between 40 and 100 people traveling with the show. And that might include all the touring personnel as well as the band and the artists and that party. And then on the average, an arena show might have somewhere between 60 and 100 stagehands for the load in and the load out. So it's a busy day.
Okay, let's just assume, for the sake of argument, I need a stage and I don't go with Tate. Who are the competitors?
You could be a competitor tomorrow, right? The barrier of entry to build one show is very low. But the barrier of entry to support that show around the world for 120 performances is out of hand high. So there's other companies that exist that have found niches in the business. And look, we don't want to do every show, right? That's not what we're here for. And some shows, we might not be able to make a difference. Some shows might be small enough as where I can't make a difference on savings during the road, right? Operational savings is where we really shine. We may be very expensive at the beginning, but at the end of that tour, we will be a lot cheaper than anybody else. That's how we market.
But is there any company close in stature or size?
I don't think so.
Okay. And everything's for sale, but is your vision at the end of the day to cash out and sell it, or do you decline offers or what?
It's an interesting question because what we go through is investors to evolve the company, right? Like, it's gotten to the point where it's quite large, and every time you want to go do a merger, an acquisition, buy a new machine, you'll get a little sick of going to the bank to borrow money. So we have taken on some partners, but the core group of the management team is in it, and we're all in it. And if you told me tomorrow that I can't do this for a living, I don't know what the fuck I'd do. I really don't.
Okay, speaking of you personally, you know, the facilities in Lititz, how many other facilities do you have around the world?
We have a place in Las Vegas. We have a couple places in London. We have some offices in Asia. But that's pretty much it. The major fabrication is happening in Pennsylvania.
Now, you used to live there and you relatively recently moved to LA. What does that look like for you with the main enterprise there?
It's saving my life, right? Because I was never put on this earth to be in charge of operations. It was survival. And at some point, it becomes brutal. I would have never expected that the business got to be as big as it is now. And that's not what I was put on this earth to do. So for me to live in LA, we work on our cell phones.
Right.
That's how we work. We work communicating. I still speak on telephone calls to all my clients. And I think that's really important. And to live out here in LA, there's enough. It's actually created more work, right? We're in the center of it all
right,
here.
Of course.
It's nuts. I was renovating our house over the summer last summer, and I spent a bit of time at the Beverly Wilshire. I did more work there than I did being at home. Like, it's a crazy town. It really is. And I'm very close to Sony Studios, which is still the best room in Los Angeles to rehearse a show, right? When the Forum changed to going back to being the Forum, there ain't a lot of places to rehearse out here anymore either. So being close to Sony is also quite nice.
How often do you go back to Lititz?
As often as they want me.
Which is what, once a month? Once every 4 months?
I was there 2 weeks ago. there's no schedule.
Okay. And how often are you on the road in general?
Well, I've come upon a time in my life where I'm very fortunate to be able to work with the people that I want to work with and work with the people who are setting you up to succeed. And I know that sounds a bit odd, but there are some shows out there that are very hard to navigate. And that's a great proving ground for our younger employees, which I don't have the mental capacity to deal with anymore.
Okay, so let's start with a brand new act. There are acts now that go on arena tours for their first tour. Sam Smith, his first tour, other than some private shows, was in an arena.
Ed Sheeran.
Right. So someone's going to be working with me who's savvy enough to make contact with you, right?
Yep.
Then how does the discussion begin?
Well, the discussion always begins with what's the germ of the idea and who is providing it. And it's never the same, right? So it could be the artist's vision. It could be the artist's interior designer. It could be the lighting designer. It could be a real set designer that they went to see so-and-so, and how do I get one of those? But it's never the same. It's never the same.
Does anybody ever come and say, I want something spectacular, but I don't know what it is?
Absolutely.
And then what happens?
And then we'll point them towards some people that we think might help them. And we'll interact with all of them. Because at the end of the day, no matter who the designer is, there is nobody better than us that can interpret art and commerce, right? We're the only people that are going to be able to say, hey, this thing right here, it's going to cost $1 million. If you want to do it this way, you could do it for 400 grand. And maybe it's not worth doing at all, right? We have the ability to take things off the paper, create a project list, an items list, and basically hand it to management as a Chinese menu.
Okay. So generally speaking, you're doing no designing.
None that we will take credit for or be paid for.
Right,
usually.
Okay. So now I have an intermediary, okay? I'm the manager, whatever. I have a vision, and I give you the vision. What's the next step?
We'll draw it. We'll create that item list, and we'll, you know, how long are you going on tour? Are you going internationally? Are you going in airplanes? Like, we've got to find a bit out. How many shows can you amortize this over? We've got to do a bit of the work that a good manager would do, because sometimes those managers aren't clever enough or don't have the experience to understand what they're getting into. So for us, everybody's got to be successful. If the tour ain't making money and we're doing great on the tour, it's a disaster, right? The vibe has to be perfect for success. And so we spend a lot of time trying to make sure that everybody's successful at the end of a tour. I don't have a lot of them that I could speak to that weren't.
Okay. So you give your proposal. Do you charge for the proposal?
No, sir.
Okay. So let's go back. You're talking about the timeline. Everything's an emergency. Okay. I decide I want to go on the road. And then I'm talking about what buildings I'm going to play, what ticket prices are set. Generally speaking, they have not contacted you yet.
Ish, but we know what's going on in the market, right? Like, we know who's going on tour, and we know, you know, once a building hold happens, the world kind of knows about it. So we can start preparing for something that we think we're going to do before they actually even contact us.
Okay, so when they do contact you, generally speaking, how many months out?
Two.
Really? That quick?
Could be six. That'd be a luxury. Usually, if you're talking about it 6 months out and you're drawing it, you're not actually contracted in beginning fabrication. It's rare in a touring scenario to get more than 2 months.
Just to go back, you did U2's Claw?
We've done every U2 show since they've been a band. Back to – the first one I did was Joshua Tree, and Michael and Willie Williams had done two before that, Boy and – I can't remember. What was the other one?
October.
something.
Okay. So, Unforgettable Fire.
But yeah, I think it was Unforgettable
Fire. Right. So, okay. So, I come to you. I tell you what I want. How long was it going to take you to draw it up and say, you know, this is what's involved?
A couple of days.
That quickly?
Absolutely.
Is there one person who does that, or
no,
is that a team?
No, there's an army of people that do that.
So, you draw it up in a couple of days. Then what's the next step?
The next step would be telling somebody how much it costs and then expecting somebody to yell and scream that that's too much. And now you've got to figure out how to reverse engineer it. Because if I give you a picture of something I want, there's 10 ways to build something. We have to find the way to build it that's best for logistics but also best for art. And sometimes it might just be a bad idea and you got to throw it out.
Okay. Does anybody ever say, okay, I like it, the cost is good, where everybody's arguing about the price?
I don't think they're arguing. I don't think it's not usually an argue. It's kind of like a commitment, and it's based upon budgets. And somebody might make a budget of, this is what we spent last year. Well, guess what? It costs more this year. Or where does the budget come from? Like, we're not privy to that.
Right.
Nor do I want to be honest with you. I'm much happier to figure out how to get to a common ground. And that involves loyalty and trust, which is a word that's not usually spoken in our industry. But we've managed to collect some of that trust and loyalty through some people that are legendary, right? Like, managers in this business, if you can get a couple good ones, your credibility goes way up, right? The Roger Davies of the world, the Barry Marshalls of the world, the Q Primes, the Bruce Allens. There's a ton of those relationships that we've had, and those people are the best at what they're doing, right? So if you're loyal and supported by those people, it's the best way to work.
Okay. So you've created the drawing. Now you're discussing budget, but how long is that process usually?
Too long. It's too long. It can go until we have to say, we're not going to make your date. That can go on for a little while.
Okay.
That's probably the longest lag. It's like, oh, shit.
Okay. And then once you decide, I know every show is different, how long does it take to build it?
It's funny because the building part's actually the easiest part, right? It's the figuring it out. You have to figure out how you're going to build it to price it, okay? You can't just price it on a whim. You really need to engineer it, which is why you have to be very careful that you're doing this with people that are actually going to do it.
Right.
Because you're going to go invest a bunch of time and money into it. And the how long does it take, that's not a fair question because how big is it, right? Like, some of these things are pretty sophisticated. But it's very rare that you get more than 8 or 10 weeks.
Okay. So, just to be clear, if it takes a couple of days to draw it, that's not what we're talking about, figuring out how to build it.
No, it probably takes 2 weeks of engineering to actually rip it out, right? Like, to narrow it down to every element, every bit of engineering. And, you know, you have to go through a couple iterations to get there. And some tours are so big, like a massive Rolling Stones, U2, Madonna, stadium show. They'll take a little longer to work out every single item.
Okay, so once it's worked out, it takes how long to build, obviously?
Whatever you got. It takes whatever you got to get to opening night, yeah?
Okay, when you have one of these one-of-a-kind shows and you put it together, how often does it work right the first time?
98% of the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're building the stage, okay? What about sound reinforcement? How does that figure in lights, et cetera?
It figures into the overall design. And you'd be surprised how many bands and designers will present you with a design that absolutely doesn't have any musicians on the stage. There's no sound in the drawing. It's just a pretty picture of an object that they call a set design. I think what we do really well is we integrate all the other people. We're kind of like a general contractor, but we're not hiring the other people. We usually have what's called the master drawing in our file, and we're able to help all those other people succeed, and we're able to lend some expertise to if there's integration between sound and video and lights. Like, sometimes there's not. Sometimes it's just hanging off by itself. Sometimes it's incredibly integrated, as well as the steel. Stage Co. in Belgium is one of the premier companies that kind of works the way we do, but with big pieces of steel to hang the PA and the sound. I'm sorry, and the lights. And there's a lot of integration that happens amongst there. There's a lot of conversation amongst the vendors talking back and forth. But we stand head and shoulders to be able to provide master drawings and drop things into these drawings that helps everybody make a real decision.
Okay. So I came with you. We agreed on what it's going to look like. You talked about these, you know, the way you don't use fasteners, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So on one hand, you have a group who's constantly coming up with new ideas. Is that – you have like an innovation team?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then – so the people
– you innovate to survive, right? You're constantly faced with a challenge that needs to be figured out almost on every show. Whether you innovate something that you're going to use again for the next 20 years or it works once, we don't know about that. But we absolutely are innovating on every single show because we're selling prototypes.
Give me an example of a couple times you innovated.
I don't think my brain could do that right now. But stand by and I'll see what comes to my mind. I'm not going there right now.
Okay. Then
it's minutia, right? It's whatever.
Right. Okay. And then – part of the budget, of course, is how do you break it down and how many trucks it's going to be, right?
Not my budget, but somebody else's budget for sure. And does it fit on airplanes? And does it fit in sea containers? And how are you going to deal with all that, right?
And you go on an arena. I mean, who takes this stuff by plane other than to Europe or Asia?
Madonna, Rolling Stones, U2. It's just a game of numbers, right? Like how much does the air freight cost and what kind of revenue are you going to get to be able to get it there quicker? Because a boat's a month to go overseas. So
Right. Some
bands don't want to hang it up for a month while the ship sails. Some bands want to go play and make the money. It's really up to the artist and the schedule, you know.
And once you're in a market, though, like the U.S., it's not going to go by plane.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, truck.
Okay. So you've been in this business a long time. What shows are you proudest of?
Wow. I'm asked that question quite a bit, and usually I'd say if it's not the show that I'm currently working on, there's something wrong. But I think some of the standouts for me have been having the privilege to work with the Rolling Stones time and time and time again.
Because are you doing the new tour?
They are the epitome of rock and roll, right?
Right. Like,
it's just amazing. And Mick is like the true CEO of an organization. And the people they surround themselves with, there's nothing like it. The Tina Turner 24/7 show was so memorable to me. She was such a legend. Mark designed that show. Jake was a production manager. It was amazing. Some of the Live Nation global tours where we're fortunate enough to work with Arthur and his gang on
U2. Arthur Fogel.
On U2 and Madonna have been just mind-blowing, right? Like, they take technology to the next level on a Madonna show and on a U2 show. I mean, I feel that U2 has single-handedly been responsible for the evolution of video in stadiums and arenas. Like, nobody's pushed the envelope. U2 has pretty much been the prototype for what everybody's doing that follows as it relates to video.
Well, certainly, you know, the first Innocence and Experience tour, that was mind-blowing about like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, but go back to like Pop Mart. I mean, whether you like the music or not,
Right. That
show was insane.
Well,
Right? Actually,
I go back to the one before that, Zoo TV.
Unbelievable.
Indoors with the Trabants and everything. I saw it outdoors too, but indoors, just one of the three best shows I've ever seen.
We rehearsed that show at Hershey Park Stadium, by the way, which was kind of convenient at the time. We didn't have a rehearsal facility, but we had a football field in Hershey, which is where we rehearsed that show. And again, like these artists that have this cycle of touring, they do it like nobody else, right? Paul McCartney, it's incredible what this man does.
So you work with Paul.
Yeah, it's just incredible what he does. And Roy Bennett is his lighting designer and his set designer. And Roy's a legend as well who comes from Prince. And he is constantly pushing the envelope with lighting and video. And you get a guy like Paul McCartney who then goes and plays for 3 hours, right?
Right.
Like not only does his show look amazing, but you got that. It's crazy.
Well, at that peak – I think we've come to the end of the feeling we know, unless there's something you need to add.
No, I don't know how I got here and I don't know where we're going. Like that's what it feels like. Like you walk into these shows these days it's mind-blowing, right? Like, you know, I read your column, and it's funny because I can remember the olden days of getting your stuff. And it's always funny when I read it because you have such stubborn opinions about a lot of things. I would never fuck with you with any of them. I would never – but, like, the music – right? It's got to come from the music. I don't care if you like the music or you don't like the music, but what we do has to be inspired by the music. And so it's very refreshing to me when, like, when I went to Buble the other night, or I just did Kelly Clarkson in Nashville. It was our second to last show, and we had Reba come out and do a 10-minute Facebook Live with Kelly, which was super meaningful to me because I'd done Reba shows in the 90s when she had 20 trucks. But to see real musicians in these arenas now, it's so refreshing, right? Like, you saw 40 horn and string players on the Where do you get to see that anymore?
Never.
Right?
I don't think I've ever seen it other than as the symphony.
And to see it so well presented in that environment, I just love it. I mean, Bruno Mars, he had musicians, right? It's so refreshing that I get such a buzz out of that, that when you see that mixed in with our stuff, it's one thing when you're building a show and you're – you're like, wow, nobody's really playing here, or there's too much choreography. But when you see that, it's captivating. And I think we embellish it well.
On that note, you've gotten full insight into Tate Towers by Weeki Fairorth. And on some level, it's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, sometime I saw Hard Day's Night during the afternoon in Lidditz. So I think I've told you that. But someday I have to go there just to see what's going on.
Yeah. I think you should.
I mean, just to see, I mean, this whole bit of how the sets come together without fasteners, I'm fascinated by that. And I certainly know all the managers, and I hear Dan Brown talk about it, Tony, et cetera. But
they're usually just telling you we're too expensive, though, right?
I won't go into everything they say. I don't want to make trouble.
But we must be doing something right. We're constantly invited back to dinner.
Absolutely, absolutely. And okay, till next time. Thanks so much, Weeki.
All right, Bob. Cheers.